Mr. O'Reilly.
May it please the court, counsel.
You don't have to tell me what the statutory citation is.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. However, I based a lot of my oral argument on the case that which shall not be named, and so to a certain extent, I'm hesitant under penalty of being shot to really discuss it. However,
I've already told you I didn't bring my phaser with me, so it's an empty threat.
I don't consider it to be that empty of a threat, but nevertheless.
What happened? The judge took out a phaser, and you remember from Star Trek, the person who was shot with a phaser would just disappear. You ever wonder where they went?
Well, in 20 minutes, I'm sure I'll be disappearing. So, at any rate, I do want to pick up. It seems to me I try to take a look at these cases from both obviously a legal standpoint, but also a common sense standpoint. This case is a little different. It involves a credit card solicitation that didn't have a minimum line of credit. If I'm an ordinary consumer, a credit card which has a credit limit of $20 is very different from a credit card that has a credit limit of $2,000. The fact of the matter is that in order for a consumer to know whether they even want this credit card or not, they'd have to apply, they'd have to have a hard credit inquiry solicitation pulled, a hard credit inquiry pulled, which does affect their credit report score. It goes on to them as a hard inquiry that's available for other people to see. And it's only after that process goes through and they're actually approved for the credit card that they find out what the credit limit amount is. Now, I don't think that consumers are in a situation where they want wallets full of consumer cards. I think one credit card with $10,000, one credit card with a $1,000 limit is much preferable than 100 cards with $10 worth of limit. And I think that's sort of what the case comes down to on this. There's clearly, if you take the broad view of the statutory definition, you say any offer. Well, was this an offer for a credit card? Sure. They said we'd give you a credit card. They'll give you a credit card. However, a consumer would not know whether they want that deal until they've gone through the whole process and actually find out what the real value of the credit card is.
Mr. O'Reilly, do you think there is some lower limit? Again, I'm looking at Exhibit A, Appendix 10 in your brief, and I guess we find out sort of from the record that there was this $300 amount, I guess. But suppose Capital One, when it sends out these your pre-approved letters, is willing to extend $100 of credit for anybody, you know, kind of a card you might take over to Starbucks a few times.
Your Honor, on that point, I agree with Perry. I think if you send out clear offers which are lousy, the marketplace will take care of you. When you send out offers in which the offer isn't, when you can't evaluate the offer because you're not given sufficient information, and what they really want you to do is to get you applied blind so they can then figure out what's going to be the most enticing offer to give you. Well, that's where the privacy concerns kick in. That's where you're eviscerating the statute of purpose. That's where you're allowing a definition which would permit anyone to gain access to a sea of sensitive credit information simply by offering some nominal amount of credit.
Yes.
I'm sorry?
I said you're quoting, but that's all right. I guess we're talking, though, about two different things, because you seem to think that if they had said, in my example, $100, you know, anyone who gets this year pre-approved, you know, from $100 on up, or they said something like that, you'd be fine, even though they would functionally be doing the same thing. Because if Eileen Price called back on the 800 number and said, I'm interested, and they pulled her credit report at that point, and it turns out, you know, she's an heiress, and they said, wow, you know, for you, a $10,000 line of credit. You still have the same after-the-fact assessment on Capital One's part as to how much of a line of credit. The mere fact of – see, I can see banks saying, okay, fine, we give everybody $50. That's practically the cost of doing business, you know, $50 line of credit, except that people might not call back if you said that.
Well, I mean, Perry's – the effective line of credit at the outset Perry was 75.
Pretty low.
Yeah, it was very low. But let me first say, I mean, clearly – one of the purposes behind this trade-off, one of the justifications that Congress had for allowing this invasion of privacy was that you'd be providing important marketplace information to consumers. If I'm given a credit card offer that says you're guaranteed a line for $1,000, I can go to my Capital One and I can say, I've got an offer from this bank that says it's a minimum of $1,000. Raise my credit limit to $1,000 or I'm going to take that offer. I can't do that with this offer. It doesn't have any minimum line of credit. I've got no idea what the offer is going to be.
So I think Congress may have had any number of policy reasons for enacting the statute the way it did, just talking about firm offers of credit, but not having further sections, not going through a regulatory process, at least as of now. So that's one layer of this, but the other layer is, what in the end, motivated as they were, did they do? And, you know, so that's, in a way, that's what we're stuck with. You know, they may have had all sorts of reasons, but there's only so far we can go with it. And if this, your pre-approved for 0% intro APR and everything you buy, presumably up to the credit limit they decide to give you, until December 2005, plus you'll get a Platinum Junior, you know, if they're willing to stand behind that, isn't that a firm offer of credit?
Well, it's not an offer that could be honored at all because, again, it gives them complete and total discretion to choose the amount of credit.
It doesn't
provide any value to the consumer without not having that term. There's no value within the offer itself because the consumer is in the dark as to whether this is an offer for $1,000 or for $10.
So is this Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical, you know, you're offering to purchase, you know, or to sell something, but you say, I'm not actually going to tell you whether there's anything in the boxcar or whether it's filled with widgets.
Or, yeah, I mean, I'm going to loan you a set amount of money, but I'm not going to tell you what the amount of money is until after I pulled your hard credit and gone through this whole credit line determination.
It's not clear if... You know, if Monty Price says pick door 1, 2, or 3 and you get what's behind the door you pick, that's not a firm offer. You pick door number 1 and you get whatever is behind it.
Well, Your Honor,
you may be unhappy, you may have buyer's regret, but you can say I accept.
Well, I understand your point, but
the problem I was raising in the last case is that after you pick door number 1, there may be a turntable behind door number 1 that says, I'm now replacing, you know, the luxury automobile with a jar of peanut butter. But if, in fact, what's behind door number 1 never changes, as a matter of ordinary contract law, you can accept what's behind door number 1, right?
But as a practical matter, I mean, certainly as a practical matter, a consumer would sit there and not really consummate the contract until they found out what was the actual terms of the offer. I'm sure, just as if you applied for a credit card.
But I don't know why, as a matter of ordinary contract law, you can't accept. Let's suppose that the letter says, we have a very complex algorithm. It's based on your credit score and a bunch of other things. And on the day you say, I accept, we will input those data into our algorithm, and that will be the deal. It certainly is an offer that can be accepted, and one would think, as I've described it, that it's a firm offer, unless they're going to change the algorithm on you while you're waiting. Sounds like a firm offer. Now, whether you want to accept, I don't know, it depends on what your other offers are, but it sounds like a firm offer as a matter of contract law, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I don't think so. You don't know what the algorithm is. There's no meeting of the minds. There's no situation where you're saying, yes, this is what I want. You're not even able to form an expectation as to what you're actually getting. In Perry, the consumer knew what the deal was. The consumer knew this is the card, and maybe it's a good card, maybe it's a bad card for that individual situation, but at least he knew. This is buying a pig in a poke. And let me just say, Your Honor, if you adopt that position,
I don't know why you can't buy a pig in a poke. Sometimes people, you know,
because
stores even say, here's a box, there's something in it. We will sell you the contents of this box. Pay us $10 and we'll give you the box with whatever is in it.
Because it allows anyone to access your credit report simply by offering a guaranteed that item which has no value. I mean, it eviscerates the statutory purpose.
Look, if it has no value, no one will accept it. No one will spend any time putting it through the mail. I mean, take my example of the store that offers boxes. They have contents, but they don't tell you what's in it.
Yeah.
Is there any question that as a matter of contract law, that's a firm offer?
No, I would think that that's a firm offer, but it's not one that would justify the accessing of credit reports. And certainly in terms of an offer, you still don't have an idea of what you're looking at.
I have a question for you, Mr. O'Reilly, even though your time, I can see, is up. I'm sitting here going blind looking at Appendix 11. I don't see offhand the "we'll change it whenever we feel like it" language in this document.
You mean they'll change the undisclosed
terms, fees, interest rates, et cetera. Is there language like that that you know of in this?
What their language is says that they'll determine the line of credit after you apply.
Right. But that's all. It's not we're and we also reserve the right to change
various
other things, because they have put, for example, in boldface, you know, the 0% fixed and then after that 14.9%, and they've also, you know, in the box on the front page said intro purchase APR 0%, purchase thereafter variable currently. So we know that the variable rate might change, but they aren't saying we might change beyond what you see on the page in this box.
Right. This is not a case where the disclosures will change. This is a case in which they failed to make
the
disclosures.
Okay.
And, of course, it's a situation where you won't have a key bank. You'll have it come in, and they'll say, we have a magic box, and you can have what's in the magic box if you want. And meanwhile, we get to access your credit report, and we can use that credit information how we see fit.
Is it not the case, though, that you know they're going to access your credit report no matter what the range is? I'm talking about the economic balance that you've been speaking of. You say, why would anyone put themselves at whatever risk there is in exposing a credit report if they don't know the amount? Haven't they made it clear that you're going to expose them to a credit check no matter what that range?
Well, there's a difference between the promotional inquiry check, which other creditors do not see, that's the unsolicited check that happened, and the hard credit inquiry check, the one that other creditors can see, which does affect your credit score. If you do the soft promotional inquiry check, then you have to make a firm offer of credit. You can only do the hard inquiry check if the action is initiated by the consumer. And so it's a situation where the firm offer of credit is supposed to offer some value to the consumer without getting the hard credit check. But in this case, you have to go through the hard credit inquiry in order to even find out what the credit line would be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly. Mr. Van Oort.
May it please the Court, recognizing that I'm coming fourth, I'd like to address three specific issues, if I may.
We're right in the middle. There are two more after you.
I'll list them. Number one is the cases that are pending in front of the Court. Number two is the definition of what an offer is in the Firm Credit Reporting Act. Leave alone firm. What does it mean for there to be an offer? The third thing is to suggest an approach that may apply in cases where a general purpose credit card is offered. Let me start with the first, which is the cases pending before this Court. There are eight currently pending before this Court. In addition to the three pending here today, there are two that have already been argued. A Murray case, 06-3846, case called Cavin, C-A-V-I-N.
Wait a minute. You're referring to Murray against HSBC Auto Finance.
That's correct.
What's the other one that's already been argued?
There's a case called Cavin, C-A-V-I-N, which is docket 07-1136. In addition to those cases, there are three that are pending on the briefs but have not yet been argued, and they are two more Murray cases. One is Murray versus GMAC. That's 07-2776. And Murray versus IndyMac, 07-3205. The final case is a Forrest case, and that is 07-3345. In addition, there are many, many more cases pending in the district courts in this circuit that have not yet been appealed.
Well, the Murray family filed 50 all by itself, so.
Let me turn then to the second point that I'd like to address, which is the definition of offer, because that's where the court has been focused, and it's critical to understanding this. It's somewhat unfortunate that the Firm Credit Reporting Act uses the term offer because it denotes images of the common law meaning of the term offer, which is something that can be accepted after the first offer. That's not the scheme that Congress has set up for making solicitations for credit. It's clear in the Fair Credit Reporting Act and in the Truth in Lending Act that there's actually a four-step process: an initial solicitation or application, and Truth in Lending Act refers to it as an application that goes out, an application that comes back, followed by a decision by the lender to make final terms, to which they then send out, and then which the consumer can finally accept. And that four-step process is built into both the Truth in Lending Act disclosures, which are in 15 U.S.C. section, let me get it right, 1637, and in the definition of a firm offer of credit in the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which, as the court now knows, is in 15 U.S.C. section 1681A sub L. Now, the reason it's important to understand offer in this context is because what the plaintiffs have argued in these many cases is they've tried to say that all the terms that are eventually comprise the offer must be listed and included in the initial solicitation. And there's no basis whatsoever in the Fair Credit Reporting Act for saying that.
Well, actually, that's not what Mr. LaTurner had said. He said only the material terms, and he seemed to think, you know, interest rate, presumptive line of credit, probably not very many other things.
Yeah, and there's no basis under the Fair Credit Reporting Act for even requiring material terms to be disclosed, because...
But how do we make sure that it's not a total sham? What if the fees were more than the line of credit? You know, you can have this card for, you know, $150 a year, and it turns out the line of credit's only $100. That would be fraudulent, it seems to me, among other things.
In the context in front of the court, there are two answers. And if I can list them, number one is that if it's an offer for a credit card, an open-ended credit card, the disclosures are regulated by the Truth in Lending Act, and it requires the disclosure of the rates, any fees, a grace period, the method of computing balance, and some other more technical things. So,
but not in this initial letter, in your view.
The
consumer has to run the risk of, you know, and the adverse consequence of having the full report pulled.
No, under 15 U.S.C. section 1637, which is the Truth in Lending Act, the initial solicitation or application, the Truth in Lending Act uses two different terms, must contain the things that I just listed: the interest rate, the fees, the grace period, the method of computing the balance. That section is what requires what everyone calls the Schumer box.
The Schumer box. I mean, you've got your Schumer box here.
And it must be in the initial solicitation. The Truth in Lending Act does not, notably, require the disclosure of the credit line in that initial solicitation. And the reason it doesn't is because the credit line is the single biggest way that lenders control the risk. And it's the one they need the most information to set. In a pre-screening context, when we talk about the privacy interests, the only thing that the lenders get in the pre-screening contest is a list of names and addresses that they know match certain criteria. They don't get a full credit report.
Of course.
And that's the balance that the Congress said, and that's the reason why it doesn't require the lenders to disclose in the initial solicitation the actual line of credit. That is allowed by the Truth in Lending Act to come later. Because the Truth in Lending Act doesn't require it, the court shouldn't interpret the Fair Credit Reporting Act to require it either.
But why not a minimum? Apparently Capital One has one, and I can certainly see that you wouldn't have any, I mean, it would be foolish to have a high-end commitment, but a minimum, it seems to me, would enable the consumer to know whether it's worth, particularly marginal consumers, whether it's worth having that credit report pulled for something that might in the end yield you only $250 or $300 in a line of credit versus something that was so trivial in terms of line of credit that the person would rather not have that activity in the credit report and save it for some worthier purpose.
I can understand, Your Honor, why from a consumer's perspective that would be useful information. It's not in the record. The reason that credit card companies sometimes don't include that is because they find that the other terms of the offer are more salient. And
that's a very paternalistic. I mean, if the statute is trying to allow consumers to control their credit, and one of the purposes of the Fair Credit Reporting Act certainly is to protect consumers in the use of this very sensitive information, especially in today's economy where there's an awful lot of identity theft and the rest, for the credit card company to say, it's good for you not to know that this might only be a $300 line.
As Your Honor pointed out, one of the purposes of the Fair Credit Reporting Act is protecting privacy. Another interest, and it's expressly listed in the same provision, which is Section 1681, no letters or anything, is the need for legitimate need for businesses to have credit information. And as you pointed out, policies only go so far, and ultimately Congress did what it did, and it balanced those policies in three ways. It limited the amount of credit information you can get in the pre-screening context. It allows consumers to opt out of this game entirely if they want to and requires lenders to notify them. And it requires that there be a firm offer, meaning an offer that will be honored provided that you meet the criteria. And that's the deal that Congress struck. And it did not choose.
But also, you're not defending the idea that that firm offer can be the functional sham.
No. It's
so
clear
how do we make sure that even your client's letter wasn't a sham?
It's clear from the face of this letter.
What's
that it is
clear
a,
about
that
any
is a
of this?
Bona fide offer of credit and not a sham to market something else.
Why should I find that to be clear?
The offers that were in this case list all of the material terms of the credit, how much it will cost you, what the fees will be. It guarantees that there will be some credit offered. It doesn't say how much. But no statute or regulation requires it to say that.
What if it were for $20 and we see the membership fee is $19 annually? I mean, I'm uncomfortable with a scheme under which there's no way to assure that this firm offer of credit is a bona fide offer.
Well, there are two things going on there. Number one, if there's an offer of credit standing alone and there's no other product with it, if the offer is for a $20 credit line and a $19 fee, that offer will likely fail in the market, and any lender who makes it will lose money and not make it again. So
eventually, as information sifts around, but there are some consumers who are duped all the time by Ponzi schemes, by everything else.
And in that context, if there are a $19 annual fee and you pay it one time, you have a $20 credit limit every time. What this question points out is the real difficulty of measuring value in some way all on its own. When you're not using it like it was used in Cole to determine whether it was a sham where you pulled the credit information to actually market cars, there you have to go into the value consideration because there's no way to tease out whether the offer of credit would have been made on its own. But when an offer of credit for a general purpose credit card is made on its own and there's nothing else to carry it other than the merits of that offer and it's subject to the disclosure requirements of the Truth in Lending Act, this court should hold that it is presumptively bona fide unless the plaintiffs identify some reason that it some specifically allege some reason that it is a sham or it won't be honored, which is the terms of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. If there are no other questions, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Van Oort. Mm-hmm. And Mr. O'Reilly, your time expired, but we asked a lot of questions, so we'll give you a minute.
And I will be brief. Obviously, you've spent quite a bit of time on this area of law already. I simply want to respond to this insofar as when you talk about whether it's a sham or not a sham, and clearly that's an important consideration. However, I do think that it's something where the narrow definition, which is urged by Capital One in this case, was already rejected in Cole, rejected in Murray versus GMAC, relied upon it in the Perry case and in the Forrest case. I mean, this is something where the FTC has really laid out the policy reasons for it. The text of the statute, yes, it could be better written. But the Truth in Lending Act doesn't require a minimum line of credit. It doesn't require any disclosure of the credit line because it's not concerned about lines of credit. It's concerned about the costs of credit, which is a totally different subject. Obviously, the amount of the credit is a primary concern to the consumer, and that's the information that would make the invasion of privacy justifiable. Clearly, if we were simply going to rely on the marketplace to police whether these offers were valuable or not, there'd be no point in having the federal statutes at all. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. This case is taken under advisement.